Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the legacy of Justice Kennedy. And Richard, for what's now the second year in a row, as we're coming to the end of the Supreme Court term, all eyes are on Justice Anthony Kennedy because of speculation about whether he will or won't retire. So we can leave that conversation to others. They can try to read those tea leaves. But this has occasioned a lot of discussion about his role on the court, including a pleading editorial from the New York Times recently begging him to stay on the bench. So why don't we just start with a consideration of what's now 30 years on the court for Justice Kennedy. During that time, what have you judged to be his strengths and his weaknesses as a Supreme Court justice?
Well, I mean, they're the same thing. The strength is that on many but not all issues, he's a relatively non-dogmatic man. And on certain kinds of technical questions like copyright and trademarks and so forth, he often writes pretty good opinions. I think he's not given to hyperbole. He's not like Justice Scalia was on a very, very bad day where he could be quite divisive. Nobody has ever seemed to upset themselves about Kennedy's decorum or appropriate behavior. He's obviously an extraordinarily influential guy because he sits there right in the middle of this particular court. And so it's now the New York Times editorial board that Justice Kennedy, please don't go. And they talked about all the things that they like about him, which are things that the conservatives don't like about him, particularly some of his decisions on gay rights, Lawrence against Texas and the Obergefell case, which just came down. So I can understand why the left likes him, because they look at Gorsuch and they regard him as somebody who, for the most part, is going to be against them. He's either going to be a conservative or a libertarian, a textualist or an originalist. What he is not going to be is a liberal or a progressive and a living constitutionalist. And so they don't want anybody like that. They regard Justice Thomas and Justice Alito as largely hopeless. And they know that they've gotten a couple of stirring decisions from their point of view from Justice Roberts, but that generally speaking, he's probably not going to go with them on anything other than epic constitutional issues. And you're not going to get too many cases dealing with the constitutionality of Obamacare or of the payment systems for subsidies coming forward in any time soon. And so they don't regard him as very good. So they see somebody coming up and making it 5-4. To make it even worse, it is almost impossible to think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be able to outlast the Trump administration. She's very frail at this point. There are all sorts of rumors swirling about her various ills and illnesses. It's quite possible that although nobody's talking about it, she will either retire of her own volition or be forced to retire, or something even worse can happen to her. She can become incapacitated in some serious way or even die. And nobody likes to talk about all of this, but you want to create a perfect stew, give the Republicans a 51-49 majority, maybe one or two Democrats willing to play along with them on Supreme Court nominations, and two open seats before the November election. This will be a very hot political summer. I think there's actually a serious chance of that happening. Ironically, if Kennedy announces his retirement, he may do it in the following strategic way. He says, I announce my retirement the moment that a successor is confirmed. I'm not even sure what the constitutional protocols on that are. But if that happens and then something happens so that Ruth Ginsburg goes off the court, you can see all sorts of permutations. If one thought the Garland maneuvers that took place a couple of years ago before our friend Gorsuch got the position, they're going to be relatively tame if they're two open seats at the same time, particularly since one of them is most assuredly liberal and the other has at least some inclinations in that direction.
Well, if we revert to the scenario of Justice Kennedy, part of the argument that was made by the New York Times editorial board in this piece is that because Justice Kennedy is unpredictable, because he's the closest thing to a centrist that the court has, that he is thereby essential to the institutional legitimacy of the court. The idea being here that if he leaves, you'll have five justices that are thought of as Republicans first and judges second, and four that are thought of as Democrats first and judges second. And at that point, the court is viewed as just another political institution. Are you at all sympathetic to that line of thinking?
Well, I certainly think it's an issue that everybody's going to worry about. But then let's take the scenario one step further. And Justice Kennedy then leaves. What are you supposed to have? Are you going to ever be able to find somebody whom you're confident enough is going to fill that seat? Are you going to say to the Republicans that you're duty-bound to do it? And then if the Democrats should gain the presidency, they say, well, of course, we fill it with somebody who is a believer in the true colors of the progressive Constitution. I think, in effect, it's something that one might like, but you certainly can't plan for it. I don't believe anybody back in 1986, when it turned out that Douglas Ginsburg was no longer suitable for the seat because of a variety of reasons, and he was appointed, that he would have that particular character. He was, after all, a Reagan appointee under these circumstances, and, you know, what are we supposed to say about this? I think what we have to say about it is that people would say that he was further to the left than they expected. This has been a general trend on the Supreme Court. I once did a calculation of taking all of the Republican appointees from, say, about 1956 with Brennan or 54 with Warren 50 years later. And it turns out that basically three seats a term were filled with liberal justices appointed by Republican presidents. I think it's much more unlikely for that to happen again because I think the vetting is much more careful. The basic turn on all of this issue came after the Souter nomination. He had no experience on the First Circuit. He came out of the New Hampshire Supreme Court. He had a couple of supports from people like Warren Rudman, I think it was. And he turned out to be probably center left. Not left, but center left. And, you know, that sent a kind of a shudder through the conservative community. And when they went to the next times with 2005, they had two people who worked in the Meesum Attorney General's office in Alito and Roberts. So I don't think you're going to find anybody from either party who's going to fill that role. And if they do, it's going to be 10 years down the road when they tend to change. There is, I think, pretty good evidence that most people, when they go on the Supreme Court, they tend to drift slightly to the left as the years go by. And that was certainly true of Sandra Day O'Connor and Bill Rehnquist. I'm not saying that they were left, but I'm saying that they were more left than they had been before. That might happen again, which means that, oddly enough, that the Republicans are in control. They're going to look for something a little bit more rock-ribbed than they might have done if they didn't think that that tendency is going to work. I don't know how the politics will play out, but I'm sure it will keep commentators indignant for a very long time to come.
Lifetime tenure for Supreme Court justices creates a sort of unusual dynamic. They're really the only major figures in American political life for whom the central drama of their careers is leaving office rather than acquiring it. They are given this enormous power to shape the course of American politics by when and how they decide to retire. How do you feel about those institutional implications from life?
Well, I think it's, you know, I have a book that I'd like to write one day. It's called Constitutional Mistakes of the First Magnitude. And I think that service during good behavior is one such blunder. I am strongly in favor of some kind of term limitations. My own preferred situation would be that you basically could serve for 18 years and then you're out, which reduces the size of the stakes. And it means instead of having people who are old where their powers may be weak and frail or may not, you never quite know, you're going to get people appointed at 46 who are going to leave office at 64 when they're at their peak of their particular powers. But that's not what the Constitution says. And so what you do is you have this situation with the gerontology autocracy can start to take over. And, you know, it's kind of dangerous, I think, to have somebody like Ruth Ginsburg, who's in her mid-80s, sitting there in very precarious health on the Supreme Court. I think she should have resigned 5 years ago when the Democrats could have appointed somebody under a secure Obama administration. That was not meant to be. But I am very much against this current arrangement. I mean, go so far as to have a constitutional amendment to change it. I would grandparent in the current Supreme Court justices so that they would have, I would put it this way, 18 years from the time that the amendment was adopted, not an unlimited term, and do it. This was just a terrible, terrible mistake in terms of the institutional organization and stability. It's too big a power. And what makes it even worse is what the Supreme Court can do now, given the wealth of issues that come before it, is so gigantic that it is very unnerving to have over a very long period of time a cadre, perhaps as small as five, that can shape the particular destinies of everything that's going on the bench. That's another thing is, if you go back even to the 1960s, Troy, you know, how long was Arthur Goldberg on the Supreme Court? A couple of years. Go back to the 50s. How long was Sherman Minton? Nobody remembers who he is, but he was on the court for 7 years. Or Charles Whitaker. We actually used to appoint people to the court who didn't like the job and quit in frustration about the way in which the thing had operated. That's just not going to happen anymore. I think, in effect, given the political stakes, you only appoint people whom you think is lifers. And as I look around on the current Supreme Court, I think we're 9 for 9 on that particular description. I certainly don't think that the Chief Justice is going to move anytime quickly. The only person who might retire in the relatively near term if there's a Republican president would be, I think, Clarence Thomas. That's my guess. So you're 8 for 9, maybe 9 for 9. To me, this is a hard point. I think the interesting question, though, in some extent, is, you know, what does one expect, or how do you evaluate Kennedy and his performance?
And how do you answer that question, Richard?
Well, I mean, look, I am less of a fan of him than others, in part for a jurisprudential standard. Justice Kennedy has, I think, two weaknesses that seem to come together that trouble me deeply. One of them is that we create a lot of 4-1-4 decisions in which he kind of votes with the conservatives but gives his own independent rationale. And then the rationale that he gives is so utterly watery and confusing that in all future cases, it turns out that the 4-1-4 that seemed to be conservative becomes liberal. Let me just give you a couple of examples which show this on important cases. Back in about 1998, there was a case called Eastern Enterprises against Apfel. And the question was to what extent Congress could impose various forms of retroactive legislation that would say about various companies who had employed workers who had gotten asbestos while they were on the job, that you could hold them responsible for it, even if they weren't responsible for it under the law at the time that the businesses were in operation, and let alone at the times that the employees were there. And so what happens is there are 4 relatively conservative justices who are very uneasy about striking down even retroactive legislation, but they cobble together a group saying, in this particular case, you've gone too far. It's too major a shift. You've gone back too many years, and you want to impose too massive a set of liabilities. And they do it under the takings clause. And Justice Kennedy makes more or less the same analysis, but he does it under the due process clause. Well, it turns out that in every subsequent decision, the retroactivity limitations that Eastern Enterprise had imposed have just disappeared from plain view. All the lower court says, well, Justice Kennedy took a different rationale. It is a constant problem for the Supreme Court to corral in lower courts that tend to be more liberal than it on certain kinds of issues. And this was an open invitation that allowed the thing to go away. I believe that retroactive legislation in many cases is an enormously dangerous issue because it allows legislations to engage in enormous shifts of wealth between parties and gives undue power to the political processes in ways that destabilize the whole system of economic expectations on which the country runs. So I wanted a strong categorical rule. I didn't want the kind of mush balancing test, non-per se rules that Justice Kennedy wanted. The second version I'd give was a case having to do with, called Rapanos, having to do with what's the definition of the navigable waters of the United States. And this is a classic illustration of kind of national travesty. If you look at the basic statutes having to do with the Clean Water Act, and you're trying to figure out what the waters of the United States or what the navigable waters of the United States are, what doesn't come to your mind is an upland which drains into the particular waters. And it doesn't seem to cover a tiny little rivulet which you can't even put down a paper boat. And so what happened is Justice Scalia wrote for a majority of 4, and he said that the whole effort on the part of the government to create wetlands as though they were the navigable waters of the United States was misguided. The liberals, going after a bunch of earlier cases which had given a very broad construction to what government powers were over waters and wetlands and other adjacent lands, they were convinced that it was a matter of administrative discretion and that you could certainly read it in a broader fashion. And this, of course, implicates the the whole Chevron doctrine. And one of the reasons why I think that Justice Gorsuch is right about this is I don't think any administrator should be able to take a definition of navigable waters, which covers a river in the Chesapeake Bay, and says that it covers some wetland for which there are a couple of drops of water a year. And what Justice Kennedy says is, I don't know what the answer to this question is. Let's do it on a facts and circumstances basis. So all of a sudden, you can't get a clear rule on this. You have to remand it back. And then what happens is all the lower court judges and the administrators take this as an open invitation to make facts and circumstances findings that essentially treat these non-waterway waterways as if they're navigable waters. And that kind of slows everything down again. You can't get a coherent environmental policy. He's willing to do that. Well, he wrote a recent takings case in a case called Muir. And the test by which he held these fellows liable was one of these crazy balancing tests, which as best I can tell was vintage gobbledygook of the worst order. He basically came out the wrong way on the particular case and gave a general rule for testing takings, which is going to get everything wrong going down in the future. And what happens is he doesn't understand that if you're trying to figure out how you set up the architecture for a nation, you cannot simply make every serious decision on land use development, on zoning, on lot size, and so forth, subject to huge facts and circumstances tests, where in fact you don't know what the answer is ever going to be, and honest judges and lawyers can disappear. Once you put that degree of freedom in a system, it simply gives exalted status to the administrative state, which means that you get the terrible flip-flap problem. You get a conservative administration, you read narrow. You get a liberal administration, and you read broad. Now, some people are thinking that, well, broad and narrow, it's a 10% difference. We can live with that. But in these cases, broad and narrow are not a 10% difference. They're a tenfold difference, which is rather larger than this. And he, I don't think, has ever been aware of that. He is not a clear intellectual theorist. I think this is a general charge that you could make amid many members of the Supreme Court, so I don't want it to be singled out. But at least in the cases that I'm talking about, he's been more wobbly than the others because there were 4-1-4 type decisions. In general, my own view about the Supreme Court is that when it comes to really important issues of property rights, contract rights, religious freedom, and so forth, the whole group of them has become much too wobbly. The question of whether there's going to be any reaction, we will know something about this and about Justice Kennedy when we start to think about what's going to happen in the Masterpiece Cake case. If he basically takes the attitude he had on Obergefell, where he says, well, I think this thing is clearly unconstitutional because I've thought about the issue and I've decided, having listened to all the arguments, that gay marriage ought to be constitutional. If he says that it goes to the anti-discrimination laws, then he's doing real harm. What's the difference? My attitude on gay marriage is a legislature, I vote for it every time. Freedom of contract to me is very important. I don't think there was anything in the Constitution that mandated it under the Equal Protection Clause, but I can understand the political stuff. But when you're trying to coerce little people to essentially follow the standards that have been set by powerful organizations, and you say to a baker who does not want to make a cake for a religious ceremony, but tells the person where he can go in order to get a cake, that this man is tantamount to inviting the Holocaust, and then it seems to me that the hyperbole is so great that you have to stop it. I hope that Justice Kennedy realizes that his ruminations in the Obergefell case point the wrong way, but you're never quite sure about him. And therein lies the problem. He's been on the court for 30 years, and he's never developed a theoretical spine that firms him up. He is worse than the others. So when I condemn him for this, I'm condemning him for a virtue or a vice that is shared by many others on the conservative side. Interestingly enough, on the liberal bloc, on the major issues, there's much more unanimity on these kinds of things. I would have been stunned if on the constitutional status of same-sex marriage, if one of the four liberals had decided to say, gee, I think this is a time for judicial restraint. So what you do is you have a very wobbly and uncertain conservative bloc of 5, 4.5 perhaps, and you have a very solid liberal bloc of 4. And if Kennedy goes and a more conservative judge is appointed, it changes things very dramatically. And if Ruth Ginsburg is not going to be on the court come the 2018-2019 term, and you actually get it to go to 6-3, it will be a major transformation of American life. And I can assure you with complete confidence that the people on the left will not be happy with them or with me or anybody else who thinks that this may not be the worst thing since the destruction of the Roman Empire.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read The Libertarian, his weekly column, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.